Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to art collector and longtime art gallerist Forrest Fenn, who has a new memoir. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Issa Nyafaga and Jenny Sanborn. They are with the nonprofit organization Hope International for Tikar People, and also its local partner, Soulful Presence. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's so good to have you back. Issa, we've had you on a couple of times before talking about your work. You are originally from Cameroon. You have had a highly adventurous life. You were a political cartoonist there. You were very severely punished for your work. You got out of Cameroon, and now you are doing this work basically to serve the people of your native country and region.
Yes, I'm serving people in my native country and also people in the United States in the communities where I live, like Santa Fe, because I think they also have a right to know what's going on in rainforests of Africa, of Cameroon. So where I am originally from, I grew up there when I was 7, and my mother still lived there. And I spent all my time, this 10 years in France and 5 here now in the United States, just thinking about that place, because I didn't choose to live in the Western world. But now I'm here, I have to, you know, deal with the reality, so bring all my network each year, or twice a year in rainforest and with my friends and do a project. So that's why I create Help International for Tikar People.
What is it like where you come from? Describe the land and the people for us.
Okay, it's not what people see in TV every day. It's very green and the soil is very red. And there is no electricity. There is no running water. There is no TV. And some people run generators sometimes. That's how it's like. And there are no hospitals. So when people are ill, they have to struggle to get to the first hospital. And I'm talking about a country who was independence. We're celebrating 50th anniversary of independence of Cameroon now. But some people still don't have a 3 meal a day in the city. But I don't want to do this project in the city because I know that government receive a lot of funding and they sit on it. I want to do this project because it's a project that people usually call in the non-profit world a pilot project, that we want to serve 12,000 people in rainforest who don't have a means. And if we succeed about this project, people will be inspired and repeat it in their own communities. Because I know there are a lot of members of the African diaspora all over the world who can also, recite this concept or be inspired and make the same change.
Very interesting. Now, what are some of the needs in your community that you are trying to fill?
First of all, we serve people with disabilities because I started this project not because I wanted to be a leader or founder of nonprofit. It was just by accident. I was 6 years in France in exile, and I heard that my parent was very sick. And, people in exile, people who was moved from their country and live in exile by force or has a syndrome of fear that you may receive a phone call that your parents pass away or somebody you really love will pass away, you won't be able to see him. I was afraid about that. So in 2002, I was 6 years in France, living there, and they sent me news that my parents both were sick, and I was afraid that I won't be able to see them again. So I have to struggle to the neighbor country of Cameroon, walk in the forest for days to just go and spend time with my parents, my mother, for 12 days
because
in that village.
You couldn't cross the border?
No,
not
officially,
passport.
Yes. Yeah. So I did that. It was very, it was nonsense decision. I won't do it again, but you have to done it. So I did it, and then while I was there, I discovered Ibrahim. It's a young polio survivor in my village. He was sliding down like a snake. I was so angry about myself because I also know that living in France, I know how much money people make, how well this civilization have been, and how much richness we have produced in this world, and people still living like animals. So I was also a social worker in the city of Nanterre. It's very close to Paris. I was like a social organizer in the art community. I had brought families and parents together to create artwork in the neighborhood, you know. Just recycle fun object to make art, decoration, and celebrate community and art around. So I put the pictures of Ibrahim around my network, you know. I blast it everywhere, and then all the families raise funds by baking cake and pie, and we was able to send a wheelchair to Ibrahim. And then we discovered that there are also a lot of people in that community who suffer from not going to the bathroom because they have injuries or they have disabilities. They can't go to school, they can't visit family, but some people also do drag themselves to go make a farm with polio. You know, we saw people like that. So I said, okay, this is the way that we can put an organization together and then make a real change. And then I was lucky to come here last 2009 at the residency program. Then I met Jenny, who really helped me because I like the collaboration, because Jenny has experience from working with the coffee farmers in South America. I offer her to repeat the experience in another community who looks similar. And then now Jenny and I are collaborating very well because I give her a key to read my society, and then if he give me a key to read society here in the United States. So yeah. I think it's very team collaboration that's working very, very well. And I'm very lucky to have Jenny in this project with me. And she have been there twice.
You've been twice to Cameroon.
Yes. I have. Yes. Yes.
Tell us about it.
Incredible. Incredible. As Issa said, I had worked quite a bit with communities in Latin America doing sustainable development work, but I had never traveled to Africa. So this was my first experience. I went for a month last year and 6 weeks this year. And just the spirit of collaboration and openness and ingenuity in these villages where we work is totally inspiring.
I mean, it seems like when you were here last and you were describing just the simple fact of getting somebody a wheelchair, that changed not only that person's life, but the lives of a lot of other people around them, because that person then becomes a productive member of society.
Right, right. Because I also leave that to Jenny, because Jenny is now a member of my community, because last time we went to Cameroon, she has a naming ceremony. So the chief honor her by giving her a name, and we get the mask up to celebrate her name.
What's your name?
My Tikar name is Mundoto Unganji, which means the first daughter of the chief.
Nice.
So a deep honoring that I never would have expected. But again, that's a reflection of the community saying you're not just helping individuals, you're helping the entire community. And that's their way of honoring someone who does that. And as you said, a wheelchair isn't just going to change one person's life. So Ibrahim, for example, he got his chair. He's now doing HIV/AIDS outreach work because he has mobility. So he's affecting the life and health of his whole community. He's the local soccer coach. So he's now improving the lives and providing leadership and support for youth in his village. And it was actually his brother who used to have to push him around in a cart. So they were, you know, constantly connected to each other. And now that brother can work his own farm. He has his own freedom and mobility as well. So it opens up possibilities for individuals, their families, and the community as a whole.
Now, here in Santa Fe, you have collected medical supplies, including a wheelchair and crutches and canes and all sorts of things, and you brought them there the last time you went.
Yes, we always take them with us in our luggage because we haven't quite yet figured out how to ship more things. So we're still getting there, and also we need help. You know, we need people who can tell us, like, I know the way that you can ship things, you know, in a humanitarian way in Cameroon and help the community more, because our organization is very small, but it's very efficient, because when people donate, in just few months, we return information. We send them back pictures, because we go with the supplies and set up them in the middle of the village and do the speech and say the name of each donor and what they do in the United States. Actually, we're trying to create bridges between communities. You know, it's not like those big organizations that when you donate, it's just like you throw something in the sea and you never see it again.
Right.
You know, but this organization, Hope International for Tika People, and our partners like Soulful Presence and other institutions, for example, El Museo, who help us to raise funds in this town, they know what we're doing, because when we go to Cameroon, we brought information back and then send them to them. And then they know the name of each person they haven't met yet. So that's the way that the organization works. It's just transparency.
There's no bureaucracy whatsoever. Basically,
people
donate a wheelchair and you guys put it in your luggage and take it there.
Yeah, sometimes we travel with wheelchair, like we had people with disabilities, and get them to Cameroon and donate them to somebody. And the person's very grateful to send our information back and say, that's really helped me to go around or to go to school or to get my stuff done. And, you know, that's what we want to do.
We're talking to Issa Nyafaga and Jenny Sanborn of Hope International for Tikar People. So you went there, and you were there for, what, 6 weeks this last trip. Tell us more what happened.
Okay, I'm going to take the first part, and Jenny will take the second. So the first day, because we brought some people like Anita Woodley, who is African-American. She produced a radio show in North Carolina, and she found her DNA being from the Tika people. So we took her, and we know a professor of university, Yaounde Wan, who is studying my tribe, the Tika people. And so we put up a day conference with student of art at University of Yaounde, and the topic was art and technology. And then Jenny did intervention about art, media literacy. And we have another person who's Michelle Polly, who does a low-powered computer project with solar panels in the village. So we opened the school with a low computer project so people can, women actually can have education and be able to establish a birth certificate of the kid, because we also have a problem of kids who doesn't have birth certificate because women don't know how to read. So we have that project we did. And then the second project were to take Dr. George Bwele. He's the founder of ASCOVIM. He's the medical surgeon, local surgeon in Cameroon, who goes to a remote area and gives surgery and free drugs to people. And Dr. George Bwele does, 750 operations, surgery, a year. Each year, he gives that for free. And he brought medical volunteers from around the world, from United States, from all parts of the world. And there was 45 volunteers that weekend, the last weekend of June 2010 in my village, to give that service to the community. That's what we was there for. And Jenny?
Mm-hmm. We had a jam-packed trip. So as Issa mentioned, of course, part of that was the mobility campaign. So delivering all of the wheelchairs. We also provide locally made wheelchairs. So we're supporting local businesses for people. And then also this low-powered computer project. So in a village with no electricity, no running water, Michelle, who runs a nonprofit organization, set up solar panels and set up the first two computers that the villagers had ever seen and had ever used. And his idea is about the democratization of technology.
Yeah.
So his goal is to bring the latest technology into the heart of the rainforest so that people have to come from the city to these villages to actually experience the latest technology. So he's kind of turning that model on its head.
And what are they doing with the technology?
This is a great opportunity then for access education. We're also focusing on individuals with disabilities being involved in the project, because it's this great sort of leveling activity where, you know, disability is not an issue. It's accessible for everyone. So they're working on literacy issues, basic reading and writing, and just basic computing skills. Internet is not available there yet. We don't know when it will be. They actually just got a phone in the village a few months ago. But it's really, like all of the projects, it's about increasing participation of women, of girls, individuals with disabilities.
Are women and girls usually not educated as much as their male counterparts?
Yes, because there are also polygamy in the country, and it's legal. Like anyone can marry more than, you know, 12 or 10 women as he wants. And I was grew up in polygamic family. My father has 4 wives. And I saw his wife suffering a lot. As a member of a community who I live in the Western world, I am not agree with polygamy, but I cannot come and say it. The only thing I can do is build a school in 7 or 10 or 15 years, women can grow their mind and choose the way they want to live. Because if I ever come and say, you should not be a polygamist, they're going to say, you're coming here with brainwash from the Western world. So I don't want to do that. The only thing I can do is bring my friends, bring supporters that can build schools, and the girl can access education. And actually, the community is thinking that's a very good thing. But they don't know that people can choose the way they want to live. And also,
now, historically, in a place like, let's say, in a polygamous society, when women get educated, does polygamy go down? Is it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, because polygamy was also created because men was going through the war, and then there was actually no lot of men to grow the demography in the villages.
Right.
So then they create polygamy for that reason. But today we're living the world that countries are being made, and then some societies become more civilized. So there are no way for polygamy to exist. But I did not say that I am really against the polygamy, because it's a culture. You know, women can choose the way who they want to marry. If they want to marry a guy who already have many women, it's their choice. But I am against the brainwash of parents who send aunts when the girl say, I don't want to marry that man. They send somebody else to surround her or to brainwash her to go to that man just because she's going to have a man and a roof on her head. So, you know, that's why I think being educated for women in that region is very important, because they can read a book and say, okay, I read this book that somebody can choose her husband. I want to do that here. I don't want to go marry that guy who already have a lot of wives. I want to choose a way to live, because they don't know that the other world is possible. So that's why I'm doing this project. So it's kind of like a ricochet, you know, of what I'm doing. Because we start with people with disabilities, but we're serving women. And concerning women, too, I'm going to leave the championship to Jenny.
Yes, that was another one of our projects. A woman, Aisha, who's one of the leaders in the organization, she organizes an annual soccer or football championship, as it's called locally. But what it is, of course, soccer is the national passion, you know, and so people come together around this game. So she got the idea to organize these championships around social issues. So last year's tournament focused on HIV and AIDS awareness. And so, of course, here you have this captive audience of thousands of villagers coming to see these soccer games, but also getting the education awareness raising about this important issue. So this year, spearheaded by a woman with serious vision, and it was about building solidarity and collaboration between the communities. Because, of course, there can be conflict, there can be tension,
yeah,
but how can we all work together to accomplish these goals? And that it was, again, organized by a woman in a leadership role, and male leaders really responding positively,
yeah,
in a support role to what she, the vision she had that she put into action.
Yeah. And, yeah, and sorry. And basically is that we brought chief of villages who doesn't talk to each other around the football game, so they can watch the game together, watch the final, watch the first game, and or watch all the tournament. They come together in each party and watch it, but they never sit down and talk.
Now, these chiefs of villages who don't normally talk to each other, how similar are they culturally and linguistically?
They are the same. They are from the same tribe. But also because it used to be a tribal war of influence in the country. That's another second background of the story. It used to be a competition or a little war between the chief of the villages. They are Tika, all of them. So today, there is some circles of that mood. And also, it's in human nature. You know, people like to challenge other people when they're not secure. They also think that they have to dominate other people to exist. And we're preventing about football competition, and it started from women. So we want to give a leadership to women and people with disabilities. Basically, people who are not seen in the society, and we're trying to give them a buzz, you know, so they can become a leaders. That's what we're doing.
And so when you have these various chiefs speaking to each other and you bring them together, what happens? What comes out of that?
They realize that there is nothing for them to not be talking. So they realize that They can hug each other and sit around, share the same meal, share a drink, just because we brought them around the football. And then football is very, very important in United States, in Cameroon. Sorry. USA. In Cameroon, soccer is a big thing. It's just like a religion. It's what people agree to work on. You know, it's just like music. There's the reason why I perform with music is because it's the only thing you can meet in different society. It's music. You know, all culture has music. And football in Cameroon is very important, because I also have to tell your audience that Cameroon is the population 20 million, but there is 260 tribes. So groups of tribes, different tribes, 260. So it's like a very, very big and diverse society where anything good can happen, but anything worse also can happen. So most of the time, those conflicts are not very important. They are not dramatic, but they are there, so we tend to prevent them.
When you have 260 tribes in a country like Cameroon, is there an overriding Cameroonian identity?
It is. It is. It's around music and food. For example, one of the amazing chef in this town is a Cameroonian lady called Sissi Tatpo. You know her, right?
Yeah.
And Sissi is one of our supporters also. So she's a very incredible leader that we have found by coming here, and I don't even remember, you put me together with Sissi. So she can tell you about what Cameroon identity is. It's food and music. And then the contemporary culture is the soccer. But music has been always what really, really marked with society in very efficient way.
Now, do you see little girls starting to play soccer?
Oh, yes, it's happening. It's happening, yes, now in Cameroon. And also this year we had donation from European Football Association, UEFA, and through another partner who is Rotary International, but that Rotary department is called Rotary Loman Berengère. So the person who's representing the organization who partner with us name is Dominique Boinard, and his finance the surgery of a little girl who got burned in my village like several years ago. She needed a surgery to go back to school, so he paid for her surgery. And we were very grateful to have him, because he came from France to see the project that he's funded last year before he sent somebody to, you know, missionary. And then this year he came with us and discovered that this little girl was suffering from all this scarf that was trapping her. And she cannot move, she cannot go to school and do anything. So then he paid for the surgery, and then she's doing pretty well now.
We're talking to Issa Nyafaga and Jenny Sanborn. You have done performances, and we've talked about some of these, because you've done a number of public performances here in Santa Fe where you paint. You paint your body, you paint canvases, you're doing this to music, you involve people. It becomes very much of a communal experience. Describe that to us and talk about the cultural Cameroonian roots of what you do.
Okay, this performance started because I'm trying to do a therapy to treat my body, because I was hurt by my government because of my political cartoons.
You were tortured in jail.
Yes, I was tortured in jail. And actually, it's been also a tough year for me, because my friend, my former boss friend, Fusion Jawe, passed away in a car accident. And he's the person who was like a mirror for me, because he went to prison. The Cameroonian government put in prison 126 times because of his writing. He was director of publication of the newspapers called Le Messager, who has a department of a satirical edition that I work with. And I went to jail because of that.
I would just like to stop for a moment and think about the courage of somebody who was put in jail 126 times and keeps on writing 127 times.
Yeah, because he decided that he will not leave the country, because leaving the country for him was like to give the okay to the government to do what they want. So I also want to tell the American audience that, can you imagine Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert in Cameroon? They will be in jail every day.
Yeah.
Or so that each year, each day per year, they will go to jail because of what the fun they're making about the society and the government. So they are very lucky to be in a society like this where, you know, they can say anything they want. I'm talking about the American audience, not the others. So, yeah, the Cameroonian society is also very deeply identified as a society where there are a lot of artists, but government doesn't provide any program for the mind to grow, because it's not good for them. But I was raised as a son of the forest in Cameroon, and then I paint with my mother and the other women in community on the wall, because before I become a cartoonist in the city. So I moved to France, and then I found this technique, because I was trying to have a therapy by a therapist, but I didn't have money to finish the therapy. So I thought that art can be something who can trade my body and bring also the community together, because I grew up around a lot of people. You know, like my father's house when I was a kid, there was full of people, you know, going around all over. So that's why I like people. So when I paint myself with live music, because I want also other people to start their own process. Like when they see me working, that's the first step for them to say, oh my God, I'm seeing something that I didn't know is possible. So now I can also think of how I can move on in my own personal life.
Yeah.
And they can also say, look at this person who went to prison many times and he didn't finish his life in depression. So he's still standing and do something for other people. So I want to inspire that. That's what I'm doing in my work.
Now, you, by the time people hear this, you are going to be on your way to Europe. But if people want to get involved in this work, or let's say somebody has a wheelchair or crutches or medicine or whatever that they want to give, what should they do now?
They can call us. They can also email us or donate through Soulful Presents. And Jenny, you know the way to explain that.
Yeah, and that's how we've been able to do what we've done, is through the community giving back. So one thing you can do is you can always visit the website. So we have a website for Hope International for TCARP people, which is HITIP.org.
HITIP.
HITIP.org. Yes, HITIP.org. Yes, exactly. And then also to make an online donation, we're doing that through our locally based Santa Fe partner organization, Soulful Presence. And that website is Soulful Presence, with a C-E at the end, .org.
Soulfulpresence.org. Mm-hmm. And Issa also has a site, which is nyafaga.com.
Yes.
And I will link to all of those on my podcast
Thank
site.
Thank you very much.
So you can go to santafe.radiocafe.org and just look for Issa or Jenny or the word Cameroon.
Yeah.
and you'll find it.
Pop up, yeah.
And you can find all of this. Anything else you want to let people know about before we go?
I want to say that I'm going to Italy this week, because there is a Terra Madre conference by Slow Food. Slow Food is one of the organizations who prevent...
Terra Madre, Mother Earth.
Yes, Mother of Earth 2010. It's a conference happening a lot, and this is like the 9th or the 8th edition of Terra Madre, and it's organized by Slow Food. It's an international organization who supports local food and organic food, and also animals at risk or seed at risk, you know, organic and wild. So I'm going there because the chief of my village, the TCARP chief, and some board member of HITIP in the country are coming to Italy, and it's the first ever trip out of Africa. So, and this is conference for small-scale farmers. It's going to happen October 21st to October 24th.
So this is huge. People coming from Cameroon to
from
Italy,
all over the world,
to share about food and agriculture. And
yes. So it's going to be happening. And I also have these workshops called Salone del Gusto. So it's a salon for taste. Yeah. You know, so we're going to be eating like pigs. I hope.
Well, so Italy is not the very worst place you could possibly go to eat.
Yeah, I believe so. So a lot of people are coming from South America, from Central America, from Brazil.
Oh, you must report back. Are you going to come back? When are you coming back?
I'm coming back in like 10 days.
Oh, okay.
Days.
Well, we will expect a full report from you when you return.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't get put a press release up because of, you know, the trip of Cameroon and what are we organizing. But I will send you the feedback when I come back.
Okay,
yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Issa Nyafaga and Jenny Sanborn from Hope International for TCARP people and its local partner here in New Mexico, Soulful Presence. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Marie Charlotte. And
we'd
like to thank our partners, Marcy Davis, Maria of El Museo, Cici Tadford, Deborah Olinger, and others, you know, people in this community who support the work we do in Cameroon. I'm very grateful to them. And that's why I always came back here. And I think I'm doing good. We're growing some mind in the community and around the world. And thank you so much again for having us.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Ciao.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Forrest Fenn. He is an art collector, longtime art gallery owner here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he's lived for nearly four decades. His new book is called The Thrill of the Chase, a memoir, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
One thing that I find fascinating about art collectors is that many of them have been collecting since they were very small, and you talk about in your book your collection of bottle caps, your collections of string that you had when you were very small. Does that for you, is it the same kind of collecting, no matter what the object is?
You know, there are some people that don't collect anything, and I think you have to be born with it. My father was a collector. My grandfather was a collector.
What did they collect?
Arrowheads, mostly, and ancient things. You know, we love to walk along the creek bottoms and look for signs of ancient man. My father had a huge arrowhead collection that I inherited from him.
Where did you grow up?
Central Texas, Temple.
And those things were just scattered along the ground?
Well, they weren't just scattered along. You had to look for them. But plowed fields, farmers plowed them up. But, you know, I grew up in Comanche and Kiowa country. And I remember my grandmother, when I was a little boy, telling me about the Kiowas and the Comanches running through her barnyard trying to catch chickens in Fort Worth, and her father told her to, you know, just lock the door and leave the Indians alone. If they can catch the chickens, they can have them. So, you know, that's rich in Indian lore, Central Texas, as is New Mexico, of course.
And so you collected as a child, and then you were in the Air Force for 20 years.
For 20 years.
There's a section in your memoir about finding the headstone of a French soldier.
Yes.
Do you want to tell that story?
Well, it's a rather long story. In my book, it's rather lengthy. But I went to this clearing in Vietnam, a friend and I, and we tripped over some headstones that were left over, we think, from the French Indochina War. But I tripped over one that was made of stone. And when I turned it over, it had a very poignant inscription on it. If you should ever think of me when I have passed this veil and wish to please my ghost, forgive a sinner and smile at a homely girl. And we were rushed because we had to get out of there. This was enemy country. But it preyed on my mind for a number of years, and I built a story around that, and it had a lasting effect on me.
It's striking that at least it seems to me, reading this memoir, that your sense of mortality and the kind of odd nature of time is present throughout your life. In other words, there's a moment in here where you talk about the future. And you say, well, what's the future? Give me a date. That we're always somehow looking forward and looking back in this way that's not really so linear.
In the future, there may not be a past like we've known. And it comes with technology and population explosions. You know, we're moving so fast in this planet, we really can't predict. We got into this recession. All of a sudden, we didn't see it coming. And I think that idiosyncrasy of what we're doing on this planet is indicative of what we have to look forward to in the future.
How did you actually get into the business of collecting art and having an art gallery?
Well, when I was in Vietnam, I had a hard tour in Vietnam. I was shot down twice. I lost 22 pounds and didn't even know it because we didn't have any scales. But when I came back to the States after a year, I was kind of beat up, so to speak, and I wanted to find a place where maybe the world would stop and let me off for a while. And I knew about Santa Fe, and I love Santa Fe, and it's the only place I knew of where maybe I could get a job. I knew I wasn't going to wear a watch or a coat and tie, so Santa Fe looked good to me. And I figured if I had to make a living, so I figured maybe I could make a living in art, and that's what prompted me. it was not the love of art. It was a necessity to make a living.
And so how did you start?
I traded for some property here in town and gave some money and started at the very bottom in the art gallery business. The first two shows I had, I didn't sell a piece of art. I didn't even sell a book. But I had a little bit of money left, and so I said, I'm going to spend this money advertising. And if that doesn't work, I said, I'm just going to slam the door and go do something else. But it started working. Advertising pays.
What kind of art were you selling?
Anything I could scrounge from friends or other art galleries. And I didn't have any money to buy art, but we thought we were hustlers. And, you know, we slept on the floor on a mattress, and we painted the building ourselves, my wife and I. Slowly things started to work. Santa Fe is a wonderful place. One good thing about Santa Fe from a business standpoint is people like it as a destination.
And so basically people will come here, they will discover you even without knowing that you were there.
If you have something that they want and the word gets around, they'll find you.
So what ended up being the specialties or the areas that you worked with at your gallery?
Well, since I didn't know what I was doing to start off with, I figured one thing I learned right away was that some of the art galleries in town that were not doing too well were handling the type of art that they themselves loved. And I thought that was a mistake. And I decided that I was going to handle the kind of art that somebody else loves, because I wasn't going to buy it for myself. And I've seen lots of galleries in Santa Fe go out of business because they loved what they were selling, or they were selling art by local people that were unknown. And I know there's a real market for that, and I've got a lot of respect for those people. But I just decided that I wanted to handle more expensive things, and it was hard starting out.
And so what was the kind of art that you identified that other people loved that you could sell?
The old tiles painters. There were about 14 or 15 really good painters in tiles. There was a tile society, which was 10, and then there were some painters like Nicolas Feston and Leon Gaspard and some of the others. And we started building those names. They were relatively unknown in 1972. But over a period of a short period, 2 or 3 years, while their fame mounted, and today it's a really big time.
What was the kind of art that you loved that you decided not to sell?
That I loved that I decided not to sell?
Yeah, because you say, okay, I'm not going to sell the art that I love. Was there something, were the things that you collected just for yourself?
Well, you know, I didn't have any money for a lot of years, and everything I collected I couldn't afford to keep. So I tried to keep some things, but, you know, when it comes to make a payroll, you have to make decisions. But I like Indian things, Plains Indian particularly, but Southwestern. I like pots and baskets, and I like the lore of the West and the fun of reading about the West.
You ended up doing very well at this gallery, and I thought it was interesting because you have, if I understand correctly, it ended up amassing a very large and significant collection yourself. Was there a turning point where you really started to do well both for yourself and in selling the work at your gallery?
Well, one thing that I can say for myself is that I never had to borrow money to make payroll. And that was my way I measured myself. If you have to borrow money to pay your employees, then something's wrong. But, you know, my motivation was to find a great object. Anybody can sell a great painting, but not everybody can find one. And I told my clients, I said, if you're in town at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning and you want to come see me, give me a phone number and I'll open for you.
Did that ever happen?
It happened. Waylon Jennings called me one time about 2 o'clock in the morning. He had some friends in town, and they had been drinking, and he wanted to open a gallery, and I did.
There is the process of selling objects, and then also there's the stories. And I have a close friend who worked in an art gallery for a while, and she said to me, she said, I'm not even selling art. I'm selling stories. I'm telling people stories, and that's what makes them buy.
Very interesting that you should mention that, because when I was a kid, I started making rules for myself. And one of the rules that I made later on was this. It doesn't matter who you are. It only matters who they think you are. That's how Neiman Marcus got there, and that's how Andy Warhol got there. And it goes right in with what your friend was saying. It's the story that sells. Of course, you want to be as honest as you can, but everybody embellishes just a little bit.
Now, I was reading somewhere that you bought some land that had a ruin of an Indian pueblo on it.
Yes, San Lazaro Pueblo.
And you started excavating that yourself?
Yes. Archaeology has been a hobby of mine since I found my first arrowhead when I was 9 years old in Texas with my father. And since my father was a collector and my football coach, we went out together on the weekends, and it's a wonderful thing for parents to take their kids out in the countryside, whether it's collecting arrowheads or fishing or whatever. And I grew up in that kind of an environment, and I loved it.
And so you bought this, essentially, pueblo and began to excavate it. Did you work with archaeologists? Were you pretty much going solo?
Both. I have a good friend in Wyoming by the name of George Siemens, has a master's degree in archaeology. And each summer he brings underprivileged kids from Wyoming. We call them underappraised kids from Wyoming down, and they camp out at the pueblo, and they excavate, and each one of them has a tent, and you know they stay a couple of weeks, and it's very rewarding for them and for us. We pay them a salary, or they couldn't afford to come down, and we give each one of them two pairs of hiking shoes, and you know, it's really a good setup.
That's the kind of story that I would imagine that people who are working within the institutions of archaeology, who are writing books about archaeology, would say that this should be done by professionals.
Well, you know, Mary, there's some argument there, but you know, there are things more important than archaeology. If we're going to save this planet today, we're going to do it with our youth. And we need to get them involved in something. We need to get them off the streets. We need to get the graffiti people out doing something that's productive. And I don't think any longer that we can say that these sciences like archaeology, they can't be on an island to themselves. They have to participate, and they have to give something back. And archaeology is something that's easy to love, and I don't think archaeologists do nearly enough to help the situation we find. We're in trouble in this country, particularly with our youth.
Very interesting. So have you seen young people's lives be affected and turned around by this process of excavating?
Sure. Some of these kids that come down in the summertime, we have to have parole officers' permission to get them out of the state. One boy had a $25 car, and it ran for 25 miles, and so we bought him a car. I've got some friends in the car business here, and we bought him a really good used car. And we got a telephone call from his mother and said, don't bring him back. I don't want him back again. And his father was gone, so he didn't have any place to go. We put him in a junior college in Wyoming. And I have a good friend here in town, Jim Taylor, who's chairman of the United World College in Las Vegas. We've gotten some of our kids scholarships over there. And we see these kids grow up, and I get emails from kids that were here 10 years ago, and it's very rewarding to me to see what's happening.
The book is called The Thrill of the Chase. Mm-hmm. Talk more about that title and the things in life that have been thrilling for you that you've chased.
You know, there's a great quote in the new Joe Devine book. It says, they never knew that it was the chase they sought and not the quarry. Isn't that interesting? And like I mentioned a while ago, the great thrill for me in the art business was to find a great painting, the thrill of the chase. It's easy to sell it, But to find it, to walk into somebody's house and see a great painting, it's just like finding a great arrowhead laying on the ground or catching a nice fish. And with women and men too, they go in antique shops and we go into garage sales for the same reason. It's the thrill of the chase. And I think that title fit my book perfectly.
Now, is it true that you found Sitting Bull's pipe?
No, I didn't find it, but I own it.
Yeah. You found it somewhere.
Yeah, it came out of a little museum in Minnesota where a lot of Sitting Bull's relatives retired. And I've had it for a few years. It's a very important piece.
What happens to that piece eventually? Are you going to give it to a museum? Do you know?
Well, I haven't decided. It could go a lot of different places. What I would like to do is sell it to a museum and use the money for some of the things that I think are important, like improving education for our youth. And, I've always thought that our museums are not doing enough to solve the problem either. If I were a museum director, I would take a gang leader to the museum, show him around, try to get him interested in something, and give him some responsibility, some authority, and maybe he can bring his buddies in. And I think we're desperate to do something, and that's what I would like to do. I'm 80 years old, so I'm starting a little bit late. But when I was a kid, in the 1930s and 40s, drugs meant aspirin, and the really, really, really bad kids were smoking cigarettes. I remember a bunch of kids and myself got in a friend's pickup truck one night about midnight, and we had a garbage can full of garbage, and we drove down Main Street in Temple, Texas, and we threw that garbage can out on the street, and garbage just flew everywhere. Let me tell you, it was headlines in the paper the next day, and the next day, and the next day. Worst thing that had happened in that town in a long time. And that's how I grew up, and I see things happening today, and I just shake my head. I think every generation decides that theirs is going to be the last because we can't survive the way we're going.
Well, apparently in ancient Mesopotamian artifacts and hieroglyphics that survive, somebody somewhere has written, these kids today, how are we going to...
That's true. That's why I'm saving a lot of my arrowheads. I may need them in the next war.
Now, you have done something quite unusual and I think fascinating to many, which is that you buried a treasure chest somewhere in the hills or mountains north of Santa Fe and have left clues in your memoir whereby people can find it.
I've taken this treasure chest to a very secret and very special place, and I've hidden it there. And there are 9 clues in my book. You have to read the book. But if you have an imagination and you have a pretty good mind and you have a little bit of resolve, you can find that treasure chest. The first one to it can have it.
You've also made some bronze bells with inscriptions on them.
That's right. And I like that part in my book where I talk about the future. I've buried 8 bells in jars, and all of them have sayings that I elevated around the... I cast them in bronze at a Shidoni foundry in Tosuke. And one of them says, ring the bell loudly, for he who dies with over $50 is a failure. Another one says, if you should ever think of me 1,000 years from now, please ring my bell so I will know. And I'm burying these bells deep, just indiscriminately, out in the desert. And I don't want anybody to find them for 1,000 years or 10,000 years. But when someone does find one accidentally and reads that inscription and sees my name and the date, 2007 or 2008, they're going to say, good Lord, look who this, the man that carved the Rosetta Stone, that thing was hidden for 2,000 years before it was found. And that's the kind of thing that my imagination runs wild when I start talking about these things. And I said in my book, is all of New Mexico going to be covered with houses and asphalt to the point where we can't go outside and look across the desert for the thrill of seeing nothing at all. We don't know where we're going. Things are happening too fast.
Yeah. Forrest Fenn is a longtime art gallery owner, art collector. His new memoir is called The Thrill of the Chase, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. It's really great to meet you and great to have you on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news, and then jazz.